When Beyond Zero Emissions in Melbourne came up with a 10-year transition plan for renewable energy, that was back in 2010, there were some people who went, oh, no, it's not really possible. But we used to say, well, look, if people really thought it was an emergency and put everything into it, could you do it in 10 years? And then they'd go, oh, well, yeah, I guess so. So I just wonder, if you asked your experts, could we go faster, how much faster could you go and how much could you exceed that optimal scenario to get to drawdown?
What I loved about Project Drawdown is that it says in the book that we're not right because it's about the future. No one's right about the future, and we say that right up front. We just took the best data and scaled it and said this is what it looks like, so we're trying to reflect back that. I have no idea what Melbourne can do. Okay. Maybe I didn't hear the question correctly because it's very hard to hear what people say from...
Yeah.
Emergency mode? If you moved into emergency mode,
okay.
Could some of those solutions go faster?
Oh, in terms of accelerating, if you can have an emergency unless you have, you know, somebody to act on the emergency, you know, which is what we're all concerned about, you know, and addressed quite eloquently, I think. The single greatest accelerator for all the solutions is carbon pricing, no question about it. There's many ways to do it, inept ways and really elegant ways to do it. But that's the policy, it's not a solution. But that policy would do more from land use to efficiency to avoided emissions to clean energy. It would be the accelerant of all accelerants. And that would, better than calling an emergency, is to call basically an opportunity.
Mm.
And people respond much better to opportunities than emergencies.
Thank you, Paul. We have another... Oh, you're recording, sorry. Where's another microphone? Someone ready with a question?
Hey, my question is for Paul. In your book, you mentioned a third grade child, a child in third grade, who said, when you said about jobs... she said, is all the work already done? And I love that because there's so much work to do. Can you outline some of the work to do? And I've got a second thing. I was very surprised about refrigeration being such a big number one on your list.
Yeah.
So what's the work to do?
Let's start with the refrigeration one.
Okay, the refrigeration. We didn't know that when we modeled the solutions, they're all intertwined. You can't model them separately. They're interconnected. And we didn't really know what they would be until February. We were just like Al Gore, solar, wind, Elon Musk, and we thought, okay, there's your hall pass to the 22nd century. And we were wrong, and I, with all due respect to Mr. Gore, I think he is too. And they're crucial, crucial solutions. When we hit the total button and refrigerant management came out number one, we were crushed. We were so disappointed. We thought, this is not sexy at all, you know. And now we have to go out with this book and number one. And it was Tom Brady, the quarterback for the Boston Patriots, you know, Gisele Bundchen's husband. And I was with him, and he said, don't call it refrigerant management. Just call it refrigeration. You know, nobody will understand it. But refrigerants basically are from 3 to 8, 9, even almost 10,000 times more powerful than CO2 as a greenhouse in terms of global warming potential. And they're just escaping like crazy, mostly in the so-called developing world. And the substitute refrigerants, they're super critical. CO2, even water in some cases, but certainly propane, ammonia, and they're being invented. It's the one solution where industry was all over us, overjoyed, because they are on it. And they were just like, you know, they could say, would you come to our conference, or would you write an article for Refrigeration Weekly? Did you know there's a Refrigeration Weekly? I didn't know. I mean, that industry is overjoyed about drawdown because actually it's the industry that loves the problem and is solving it. As far as the girl who said, is all the work done? Precisely. That's my point about our next book is called Regeneration. The subtitle is How to Create 1 Billion Jobs. Because if we want to reverse global warming, we put us all to work in meaningful, extraordinary ways that regenerate life on Earth, you know, in communities, in cities, you know, certainly on the land and the oceans, everywhere. And we do have the ways to do that because the default mode of life is regeneration. As soon as you stop killing it, it regenerates. Stop scraping it, poisoning it, you know, it goes into regeneration. And really, a lot of the solutions are really about allowing life to work again. It doesn't mean, and I want to back up David on this, that the odds aren't long. They're really long odds right now. And all I can say is, let's take them.
Paul, I like the sound of that next book. When you release it in Australia, can I suggest a subtitle, Jobs and Growth? Because that's really, it's got a lot of traction. Some of our finest leaders have really led with that one. So, and Nick, can I just check, are the votes being collected? Okay, all right, so we'll get on to collecting the votes, but next question here, please.
This one's just to the panel in general.
You just need to speak right into the mic, I'm
sorry.
That's it.
So I recently read a book by E.O. Wilson about Half Earth, conserving Half Earth, and about how that could essentially save 70 to 80% of all remaining species on the planet. And that's got nothing to do with climate change. It's just got to do with our notion that growth is perpetual and never-ending on a finite planet. And it makes me wonder whether we should be considering the whole notion of how we go about our global economic system rather than trying to address it ticky-tacky around the edges. So that's just my comment, if anyone's got anything to say.
Would you like to... Oh, Clive, why weren't you paying attention? It's okay. If you wanted to...
I'll just make one comment, if I may. It's slightly tangential, but it's to do with the ageing of the population.
Why are you looking at me? I'm only 53.
Oh, that was Freudian, Bernie. Okay, so the only way that population growth will stop is if the population ages. As long as the population is not ageing across its distribution, it's growing. Therefore, we should welcome the ageing of the population. And, you know, it's those countries where populations are ageing and that, you know, all the economists and so on are throwing up their arms and saying this is catastrophic. They are actually the only way that we can survive. There are all sorts of other factors to take into account as well. So apart from that, an ageing of the population has all sorts of benefits, not the least of which is fewer hoons.
How long has it been since I've heard a bloody baby boomer justify their right to rule the joint? Thanks, Clive. You people are the problem. No. Please, Ian.
I didn't totally get the question. It was about not just population, but economic growth generally. Is that right? Yeah. Well, look, I mean, I guess I touched on it at the end of my comments in that I think we genuinely now are at the point where the entire economic basis under which we operate has to be rethought. We have got major problems in a whole range of different areas, of which climate is just one. So that doesn't mean to say we have to move to a system of sackcloth and ashes, but it does mean that we can't continue using the, if you want to call it, the neoliberal model that is dominating at the present time. We need something different. And the problem we've got is that, I mean, there's a lot of discussion going on around the world about what that might be, a lot of very good work being done, whether you call it circular economies or whatever. But the fact is that we're not, that is pretty academic if we don't solve the climate problem, because if we don't get on top of that, then we're going to have a system where we don't have viable societies. And I think we have to be just brutally frank about that. So the first priority is to solve the climate issue and have a constructive discussion about how we do it. We know the solutions, but we have enormous barriers at the moment to implementing those in the speed we need. We also then need to rethink what system we want to put in its place. And there's not necessarily one of those. There could be different alternatives in different parts of the world. But that's a discussion we haven't even started in this country. And, you know, given the fact that most of our discourse is way back in the 19th or early 20th century in terms of thinking through this type of stuff, we've got a long way to go. So we need new coalitions of people to come out publicly and start to force the debate on these issues much more into the open than we're seeing.
Well, I think we have had a few starts along the way. Marilyn Waring with Counting for Nothing in the 80s, and there have been little bits of traction along the way, but, yeah, nothing that's really really taken the economic sector by whatever part of it would need to be taken by. Next question, just someone with the microphone. Oh, yes, sorry.
Yes. We've got the issue of methane. We've got hydrogen sulfide out on the ocean floor in Mexico, but Chenoweth says an engaged 3.5% of the population can topple what we might call our fossil overlords, or maybe a series of $1 million donations by Gina Reinhart. How do we get there? How do we actually get an engaged 3.5 or more percent of the population working on this?
Kelly?
So that study is about huge changes in governments and forms of governments in country, but it's a study that we look at very closely. And so we know the number, right? It's about 800,000 or a bit more people. And we've actually got it in Australia on climate and issues. If you look across GetUp and ACF, there's 1.5 million active, and they're very active. We measure how active they are. So maybe it's not how, it's like we've got it, but it does need to be, you do need to have very organised communities. You can't just have a lot of people on your side. You need to have very influential communities on your side. So sometimes that might be in seats that major political parties really want to win and will battle over, and they therefore have a race on environmental policy. Maybe we'll see that in Batman in the next few weeks. But also there's very influential business leaders or eminent people who have a very strong voice. Sometimes they're the farmer who is a very unusual advocate for climate change, and we know a lot of farmers who speak up. So I think it's really important to remember that we are in a time where we are in a tipping point for democracy, as much as we probably have passed the tipping point on climate, and we have to, you know, draw down, or we are past that and we have to draw down. But we forget that we are at that tipping point for democracy as well. We've got the 3.5%. It's just getting it organised and focused and believing that through their action they can create change. And that's why being clear that this is possible and that we can do it and this is how, and whether we'll achieve it or not depends on whether we all take action. And people need to believe that.
Thank you. And like with any good movement to overthrow anything, it needs to be fun as well. There's got to be an element of joy if you want more people involved and involved in a meaningful way. Okay, next question. We're waiting for our down the back here. Yes, thanks.
This is a question for the panel in general. I'm just interested in a few of you mentioned about the difficulty in getting the message across the public. I'm just interested in your opinion as to the significance of traditional media nowadays, in the sense that we've got media organisations, newspapers that are dismissive of environmental issues. You've got radio stations which politicians can get onto and expels their views without question. You've got other newspapers like Fairfax that seems to be drawing back a bit on environmental issues. It doesn't seem to be getting the cut through that it once did. And I'm just wondering, is traditional media still the way to get the message across, or do you have to look at other ways to really try and get to the people?
Anna, you're smiling, so I think you've got something to say.
I think your question touches on the point Kelly was making, that there is a shift going on in democracies and in societies, and that's also how we the shift in how we communicate. It's not to say traditional media is not still important. It does set a lot of the agenda that governments still listen to. But what our research shows is, and what we see globally with the shift in democracies and what's happening in America, is that there is a breakdown of trust between audiences and institutions. Media is one of those institutions, governments are another. And what that has shown us is that where the trust exists is peer-to-peer, person-to-person. And that's actually why Facebook and social media has really taken off and is supplanting traditional media as places where people go to communicate. So we can tap into that rather than just observe it and use what we've learned, that trusted communication is peer-to-peer, like with like. And so we are now investing in sharing our evidence and our research on the solutions with organisations who can then reach their own, their members, their staff, community organisations and communities. So it supports the people power type of message, but it's also about making sure that we tap into that, that where trust lies is where information sticks. So let's make sure we get good information that's accessible into the hands of people who will then share it with their peers.
Okay, one more quick question. Who's already got a microphone? Because we've got the results. Oh, there's some down the front.
Okay.
Well, we're going to have to go with, I think we've got a fairly, who's still got number, who's still got votes? Quick sticks. Can you count them and add them to that?
Sorry?
Anyone else still got votes? Apologies. I don't know if anyone else was in one of the many elections of Joe Bjelke-Petersen in the 70s, but I'm kind of feeling a little gerrymander action is underway here. Yep, got all the votes now? Okay, so we have got time for more questions. Well, well, those votes get added on. And here's the total. All right, I'll add it. I'll add it on. Very good at maths. Okay, questions? Sorry, with the microphone, I can't see. Yep, thank you.
My name is Pia. I'm an environmental lawyer from Chile, South America, and I'll be doing as much as I can to contribute to the discussion on climate change. But my question is, what we can do on a daily basis to contribute? Because I've read that, for example, we could reduce the amount of meat that we're eating every day. So what is the opinion on the panel on the most important thing that we can do as citizens on a daily basis to contribute to this problem?
Okay, most important thing we can do apart from refrigeration as citizens, and one example there, reducing meat consumption.
Now you're going to be surprised at my answer. I have no idea. We just met.
You have no idea what?
We just met. I don't know you. I don't know who you are. I don't know the most important thing you can do. And if I tell you what it is, you should run. Okay, and that's been the problem with call to action. Is it an idea that is a white, charismatic male vertebrate who knows what to do and is telling you what to do? And believe me, that's the problem, not the solution. But what I suggest is, and that's why with Drawdown, whether it's the website or the book, it doesn't matter, you know, basically, to me, it's about looking at those different ways in which humanity is coalescing and addressing this. And what is the one where you just, you know, you just light up, you know, your eyes, your heart, your body, you know, you just feel, I wish I know that, or I wish I knew more about that, or this is something I'd really like to be involved with. Educating girls is the number six solution, you know. I mean, there is the solution for you, because it has 1,000 other co-benefits besides reducing, you know, greenhouse gases. And the only difference between that, the number comes from basically empowering young girls to have an education that's comparable to high school, and they become a woman on their own terms, more or less, much more than they would be if they're yanked out of school. And their reproduction rate is actually just 2+ instead of 5+, so forth. Some people look at that. Some people look at some of the agricultural ones. Some people look at some of the social things, like plant-rich diet is number four. That's behavior, but we can measure that one because we know what the food intake is of the world. So that's what I would suggest is take some time and figure out what it is, you know, that actually completely lights you up. And that's the one thing you should do.
Nice answer. Clive. Oh.
Well, I'd like to suggest a different one, and that is that the capitalist system and the power structure that goes with it wants you to think that it's your individual responsibility for this. And it's not. It's the system. It's the power structure. It's the people who make decisions in oil companies and other big corporations and the governments who support them and the vast advertising industry that manipulates our behaviour. It's not whether you buy this fridge or that fridge. I mean, look, we all do that kind of thing. Sure, more power to us. But that's not going to solve the climate change problem. It's a collective problem. It's a political problem. That's why it's such a vast struggle with very powerful forces. And we must not forget that.
Oh. Spoken like a true Jedi Knight. Well done. Thank you, Clive. Now we have the absolute final no correspondence entered into results. Hilariously, can I just say, Anthony Green would not have predicted this at all, but the result of including those last 20 missing votes was adding 20 to yes on each of the questions. So we've ticked the box and we've yesed it up. But interestingly, on the issue of whether we think the goal of reversing global warming is technically possible, no, 15 people are not convinced it's technically possible. 47 of you think maybe, 140 are convinced that yes, it is technically possible. So that's an interesting split. Do you think the goal of reversing global warming is ethically justifiable? No, 5. We will hunt you down. Maybe, 11. And yes, 174. There's just no such thing as a homogenous crowd. Do you think we should reverse global warming? No, 5, maybe. I know, I'm seeing a pattern there with those. Come on. We didn't say anything about a secret ballot. Name and shame. No, 5, maybe 3, and yes, a resounding 182. So whatever that means, the yeses have it. Would you join me in thanking our spectacular speakers? And I do, before we leave, I do just want to read out the 3 comments that we received. One is, we have to try. Okay, so that's a nice emphatic up, we have to try. The second is, these are stupid questions. Yeah. And the third is, you desperately need a reality TV show to promote this idea. Great. Know who I don't want starring in it. Not these people, that other famous reality TV star who has been mentioned once or twice tonight. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy the rest of the festival, please. Give it up one more time for our speakers. For SLF, for RMIT and Future Super. I'm sure each of our speakers will be able to hang around. We'll all be heading over for a drink over at the bar pretty soon, I think. So make sure you catch us if you want to have a chat with anyone. Paul's books are for sale at the back and he'll be signing them. Happy to sign them. Thanks very much. Enjoy the festival.
Thank you. Thank you.